Today's guest said that when her son was born, she experienced flashbacks of being hunted by the Nazis. But how is this possible? It was spring of 1997, and she was living in Massachusetts. We'll find out in just a minute. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Dr. Tammy Botner. Dr. Botner is a pediatrician with over 20 years of experience, and today she joins us as the daughter of Bobby Botner and the author of Among the Reeds, a true story of how a family survived the Holocaust. Dr. Botner, welcome to Mind Talk.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, I would like for you to explain how it is that you could experience flashbacks of a time in which you did not live, of experiences that you did not personally have. How's that possible?
Isn't that strange? It was really one of the most scary things that's ever happened to me. As you said, it was 1997, and I had my first child, and he was healthy, and I was already a pediatrician, so when I brought him home, I really wasn't as nervous as most new moms are, because I had a lot of experience taking care of little children. But when I got him home, I started having these incredibly real feeling, almost like waking dreams or flashbacks or, you know, some kind of experience where I felt like it was happening to me in real time. And I had these really terrifying experiences thinking, what if there were boots pounding up the steps? What if we were being hunted? Where would I hide? Where would I keep my child? What would I do to keep him safe? And it was a really bizarre and terrifying experience. And eventually I realized that those must have been the feelings, thoughts, and experiences that my grandmother had had when she gave birth in 1940 to my dad, because she was in Belgium at the time. It was at the dawn of World War II, and she brought a newborn baby boy home and obviously had a terribly difficult time. 3 weeks after my dad was born, the Nazis invaded Belgium. So I didn't know what to do with that weird thing that had happened to me. And it wasn't until a few years later when I started to learn about something called epigenetics that I began to think that perhaps this wasn't just musings or thinkings. This might have actually had some kind of a genetic echo that I inherited from my predecessors.
Now, you know, as you describe it, it sounds supernatural. I'm sorry. Let me just say that again. As you describe it, it sounds almost supernatural. It sounds like it's just not it's not possible. And maybe it was something that you were, I don't know, maybe you had read a book, or I'm sure that's what some people are thinking. You read a book, you saw a movie.
Yeah.
You really were more anxious about being a new mom than you realized.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it might have been partly that. You know, there are studies now that show that survivors of the Holocaust have alterations to their genes, and specifically they have alterations to the genes that control stress hormones. So on some level, that's not that surprising. Once you realize that genes can be modified, it makes sense that someone who lives through 5 years of incredible anxiety and stress and difficulty would have some modification to their genes. But what's even more interesting is that we now know that those modified genes can be passed along to subsequent generations in that modified state. So that's work that's being done in various places, but one of the big ones is in New York at Mount Sinai Hospital. And researchers there have actually identified a genetic change in Holocaust survivors and in their children. I don't think it's as simple as I inherited my grandmother's memories. I don't think that happens in that sort of very specific way. But I do believe, and there's evidence to support that, that I've inherited something. There's some kind of genetic echo that came down through the generations. And perhaps because of circumstances at the time, I had a new baby, I had seen a movie or whatever, it all sort of clicked into place. And I don't think it's as simple as nature versus nurture. And in fact, one of the most fascinating things about epigenetics is that it's that the environment does cause changes to the genes. So it's a real marriage of those two experiences that results in some changes.
The story that you tell in Among the Reeds is truly, it's written, first of all, I have to say, with a great deal of grace and passion and compassion. Why is this such an important story? Why was this such an important story for you to tell?
Well, it was an important story for me to tell on a personal level because this is what my grandparents and my dad actually went through during World War II. And as Holocaust survivors are getting, we're so far out from it now that not very many survivors are still alive. In fact, mostly it's just child survivors that are still alive, my dad being one of them. He was only 2 years old when he was sent into hiding, and I tell that story in the book. He was sent into hiding by himself. So it's really important to tell the stories because those people are not going to be around that much longer to tell them. And if we don't learn from the past, if we don't look around and remember what happened, then shame on us because terrible things happen, and we don't want to repeat those things. And, you know, it's really strange because when I wrote the book, the political times were a little different. I wrote the book last year, and right after it was published, all kinds of things started changing in this country and around the world. And some of the things that we've been seeing with the rise in hate groups and white supremacists and all these fringe hate groups that are suddenly showing their faces on the city streets and being vocal, you know, I never expected when I was writing the book that the book would be as pertinent and as timely, unfortunately, as it actually turned out to be.
Well, I have to tell you that as I was reading it, there was such a chilling, there was almost a chill that went through me as I read the description of what your ancestors, what your grandparents were saying as Hitler came into being. Can you share that with the audience?
Yeah. So when Hitler was first elected chancellor in Germany in 1933, the country was very divided. Germany was a divided country, and there were most people thought of themselves as being liberal, as forward-thinking, very cultured people. But there was a big division in the country, and the disenfranchised masses actually voted Hitler in. Most of the people, when Hitler was voted in, were appalled, and they thought, this is a buffoon, he's an idiot, it won't last, he'll be gone, he's speaking madness, but it's just going to be temporary madness. And, you know, I am sure as I'm talking, people are thinking, oh, that sounds vaguely familiar. You know, it's very chillingly similar to what we have seen happen in this country in the last year.
It really is. What was it like for you as you began to realize post the publication of Among the Reeds how similar the circumstances seemed to be? Did that bring up anything for you in particular?
You know, it was terrifying to me. In August, when that Charlottesville rally happened.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know. I live, you know, in the Northeast, and to me, I could not have been more shocked. I could not have been more shocked that was actually happening. It seemed like it came out of the blue. And when I watched it on TV and I saw I don't know, I think it was like 20,000 people, if I'm remembering correctly, marching in the streets, screaming Nazi slogans, brandishing swastikas, and saying things like, Jews will not replace me. I have to say, I was absolutely terrified. And I thought, is this even possibly happening in 2017 in the U.S.? Like, that felt like a flashback to 1935 Germany. I mean, you know, who are these people? Where did they come from? And how is, you know, were they always there? And is it just the current administration's policies that are allowing these people to suddenly feel confident enough to come out? I don't know. But it really, it struck such a deep chord in me. And the one good thing I will say is that in response to that rally, a few weeks later in Boston, there was a huge counter rally, and I think something like 50,000 people showed up on the Boston streets and marched against white supremacy, and that was just a wonderful counterpoint to, you know, to what we had seen in Virginia.
It is indeed true that the times are quite challenging for many people, and I certainly that's putting it very, very mildly. Tell us about your father being sent away at the age of two. What was going on?
So in when the Nazis took over in Europe, they very systematically started passing laws that limited Jews' rights, and it wasn't. It was very gradual. It was always like one more step, one more step, one more step. And it was done in a very chillingly well thought out way. So people lost their ability to shop in certain stores. They lost their right to ride on public transportation. Then they lost their jobs, and their kids were kicked out of school. Then they lost their homes. They had to move into ghettos. You know, it was just one thing after the next. In 1942, they forced people to start wearing a star, a yellow star on their clothes that had the word Jew written in French, Juif, on their clothes. And at that point, the next step was that the Nazis started going into people's homes, businesses, factories, wherever people were congregated, and arresting anyone they could whose documentation showed that they were Jewish, and sending them away, deporting them. And 99.9% of those people would never return. I'm saying all this because it's important to understand what was going on when I tell you what happened next. In that time and place, it was very unlikely, if you were Jewish, that you were going to be making it through the war. And my grandparents knew that, and they were, at that point, the parents of a two-year-old child. My dad was two. They also knew that there were resistant groups who were working to hide Jewish children to try to save their lives. So my grandparents made the unbelievably difficult decision to send their child away into hiding by himself at age two.
Which is,
and the reason they did that is that they anticipated that any day they would be picked up and arrested and deported, and they were desperately trying to make sure that if that happened, he wasn't with them, so that he would at least have a chance to live.
Tammy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up right here.
Great.
Tammy Bottner, author of Among the Reeds, continue with the story of your dad at the age of 2 and what his parents chose to do in order, hopefully, to save his life.
Jews were being arrested and deported, and there was a network that was working to hide Jewish children in various places, and they made the decision to send my dad away. There was a very, and Belgium was one of the best places for this kind of underground hiding network during the war. And what happened was a woman who was in her early 20s, her name was André Goulin. She was a Belgian school teacher, and she had been recruited to work for the Belgian resistance. And so one day she came to my grandparents' apartment and promptly just, you know, picked up my dad, who was a 2-year-old kid, who didn't speak French, by the way. And she spoke French, so she was unable to really speak to him. But he knew enough not to talk. His parents had told him, don't talk, because he spoke German and Yiddish, and it would have been extremely dangerous out on the street or in the train to speak those languages. So he was quiet. And she picked him up and took a train out into the country and brought him to a convent. And in the convent, there were nuns who were hiding Jewish children in the basement. He was brought down into the basement where it was dark and it was cold and it was scary. And he was all alone, and André Goulin passed him over to the nuns and then left, because her job was just to be the, like, the escort, the person who brought the kids into hiding. She didn't actually stay there. And then he spent 6 months in that convent. After 6 months, he was so despondent and depressed that he got sick, and the nuns thought that he was dying. So they contacted the resistance, and they sent him back home. He spent a few weeks back home with his parents, where he promptly became perfectly healthy. And then, once again, because things were escalating and it was so dangerous, my grandparents sent him away again. And that time, he went to a different convent where he spent 2 years. So he actually spent a total of 2.5 years before the age of 5 by himself in hiding in 2 different convents and estranged from everyone he knew.
You know, it speaks volumes to so many things. The fact that children actually can be depressed and anxious, which, you know, for years, adults really didn't have a sense that that was even possible. We're better at it now. But I mean, this really underscores it in such an incredible way. Also, yeah. the fact that your father at the age of 2 was able even to follow the directions that he should remain silent is pretty miraculous.
I know. And in fact, the kids in hiding had to be quiet for the whole time because the nuns were terrified that the Nazis would come around. And if they heard the sound of kids playing and talking and doing what kids do, they would go down and investigate. What are these kids? Who are they? Are you harboring, you know, people you're not supposed to be hiding? So they made the children be quiet for the whole time. So they basically never got to run around and play, and they weren't taken outside, and they had to stay in this fairly stark, cold basement the whole time and be quiet. It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't know how anybody really can wrap their heads around having a child have to go through that for 2.5 years. I can't even imagine it for a day, frankly.
You know, it's almost like being in solitary confinement with a lot of people around you.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think my dad felt that way, in fact, because he wasn't able to communicate effectively. He was so scared and turned in and, you know, sort of shut down that he never really learned how to speak French. He did later in life, you know, after the war. But at that time, he wasn't communicating, and he was just sort of like almost like figuratively curled up into a ball and waiting for it to end.
That's what it sounds like. And you know, the other thing that this points out is the power of connection for children. He was looking as though he was at death's door. and then a few weeks with his family. And it was almost as though he was resurrected.
Oh, I think it took a couple of days, actually, with his family, and he was absolutely fine. But they kept him for a few weeks because, of course, they were desperately sad. They, you know, you can only imagine parents having to give up their child, and he comes home, and he seems healthy within a couple of days. They didn't want to give him up again, but, of course, they had to.
As they gave him up, tell us what was going on in your grandparents' life. You talked about a time that your great-grandfather put poison drops in his eyes.
That was earlier on. That was, my great-grandfather had fought for the Austrian army during World War I. So that was a previous time.
Okay.
But, you know, it's, and I'll tell you the story, but it just shows how, you know, how bad things were over and over and over again, sort of no matter where they went and what they did. So during World War I, when my great-grandfather, Leopold, was enlisted to fight in the Austrian army, they were sending Jewish boys to the front, and they were basically cannon fodder, and it was pretty much a sure thing that they were going to be killed. And so what he did, which apparently some other people did too, is he found these drops, and apparently they were available, and I did a lot of research trying to figure out what they were, but I wasn't actually able to figure it out. But he put some kind of drops into his eyes that didn't exactly make him blind, but really, really affected his vision. And that's how he managed to be excused from military conflict. You know, he got out of the military that way.
So that, in fact, saved his life on some levels.
It did save his life. That's right. It saved his life. He didn't have to fight. And he got out of military service. You know, what's really interesting is that both my great grandfathers fought in the Austrian army during World War I, and that, you know, was basically like the German side, and those were the people that then turned on them, and in World War II, and didn't matter if you had fought in their army 20 years earlier, if you were Jewish, they were going to kill you.
It's stunning on so many levels. The fact that it's a true story, that it is remains true on some levels, even as you said in 2017, it really is stunning. Tell us about your grandmother. As a child, she had quite a challenging life.
Yeah, my grandmother was raised in Germany. And she was in a city called Chemnitz, which is an industrial city in what later became East Germany. And when she was a child, Hitler was coming into his own, and so she saw what was going on in the city streets and the rallies and all that stuff, and it was really terrifying for her. But what happened was that in March of 1933, when Hitler had just come to power, her father woke up one morning, and he was a successful businessman in Germany, a Jewish businessman, and he woke up one morning and he said to his wife, "I had a dream that the Nazis are coming for me, and I'm leaving." And she was like, What? Where are you going? What are you talking about? And he said, "I have to go. They're coming for me." So my grandmother was a child, and her father packed a bag, went to the train station, and took a train to Holland, and he was gone. And the family was completely confused. You know, they had a business. There were three small children at home, blah, blah, blah. Well, the next day, in fact, the Nazis did come looking for him. They pounded at the door. He was gone. And they searched the entire house, and they were very scary, and my grandmother, you know, was terrified that these soldiers were, with bayonets, were going through the house looking for her dad, who was no longer in the country. And when they couldn't find him, they placed the family under house arrest, told them they weren't allowed to leave the house until the father, or, you know, the man they were looking for was there. So what happened was my great-grandmother decided she was going to take her kids and leave. And they had posted a soldier at the front door, but they hadn't guarded the back door. And so one by one, they left the house, including the kids. My grandmother was 11 years old, and her mother told her, walk to the train station, I'll meet you there. Her sister was only 8, and her brother was 5. So an adult did take the 5-year-old, but the girls walked on their own to the train station, and then my great-grandmother did too. She met the kids there, bought a ticket to Holland, and they left Germany in 1933, never to return. And that's how they escaped. Of course, they didn't escape out of Europe. They were in Holland for years, and they were in Belgium during the war, but at least they got out of Germany. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's like a prescient dream that he had.
Not only is the dream amazing, but just the fact that these children were walking by themselves in such scary times to the train station and weren't stopped.
I know. And you know, one of the themes that came up for me again and again as I was researching and writing the book was none of the children in my grandparents' generation or in my dad's generation really had a childhood. They had to become adults when they were extraordinarily young because the times were so dire that there was no option. You know, it wasn't like they could just have, you know, what we think of as childhood, which is really an innocent time with very little responsibility. That just wasn't the case at all. My grandmother, like you said, you know, she was walking to the train station when she was 11 to escape the Nazis. And my dad, as we know, was sent into hiding by himself when he was 2. So there was no childhood for these folks.
And a chronic state of anxiety and fear.
Absolutely. For years.
At one point.
You know, and that's what I think. That, you know, and that's why I think there must have been, and, you know, there's documentation to prove it, but just in my own family, not a big surprise that there's genetic changes. I mean, to live in constant fear where your stress hormones are sky high, it's just a matter of high and higher, right? I mean, they never really go down for years and years and years.
It really does speak, excuse me, it really does speak so much to the, again, the impact of stress, the impact of chronic stress. And, you know, there are certainly some groups of people for whom chronic stress is so far above and beyond even what the average person walking around thinks of as stress.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good point because you don't have to have been a Holocaust survivor to experience chronic stress. A lot of people, as you said, have terrible stress in their lives, whether it's, you know, homelessness or an abusive relationship or illness or, you know, all kinds of things. And what we can take home from that maybe is that does have an effect on people's future health and on their children's health, potentially, if they have children after that. And so, you know, one of the things I try to work with my patients to do is around stress management. Obviously, what we're talking about are extraordinary circumstances, but increasingly in my work, I see teenagers who are experiencing a terrible anxiety over things that are not extraordinary, if you know what I mean. So these kids are not having these horrible, you know, they're not homeless and they're not being beaten. They're just having sort of teenage stuff happen, but they're internalizing it as terrible anxiety. And I think what I would like to encourage people to do is think about ways to diffuse that anxiety, whether it's mindfulness or exercise or various things, therapy, to try to bring those stress hormones down because it does have an impact later on.
And again, it's so critical to recognize that you don't have to be over the age of 21 to experience life and health affecting stress. We've got to be clear about that.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a pediatrician. I work with children and adolescents, and Well, you know, I'm sure you know, but there are so many anxious and depressed teenagers in the country right now, and many of them are having suicidal ideation, and it's a huge problem in our world right now.
And, you know, again, those parents whose sense of their children is all you have to do is to go to school, I don't know what your problem is, really need to open up their own awareness and recognize that there are huge stressors for us all.
Yeah, yeah. And find ways to cope, because, you know, I think the teenagers that I'm working with, they're so stressed, and I think, God, you know, things are not going to get less stressful as they get older. Things get more stressful.
Exactly.
And one of the things I really encourage them to do is turn off their phones, because I am convinced that one of the reasons that teenagers are so incredibly stressed is that they never have any time to heal. They are just bombarded constantly with social media and making their lives public every second of every day, and seeing things that they view as they were excluded from this, or, you know, they weren't included in that. And I think that that is definitely contributing to the bad mental health of our young people.
You know, it sounds like we could have a whole other two or three conversations just about what's going with teens. At one point, your grandmother was forced to marry, and she was just 17. How did that happen?
Right. So it was 1939, and my grandmother was 17 years old, and her father had a nervous breakdown, and so he wasn't living with the family anymore. He was hospitalized. So she was the eldest child. Her mom and three kids were living in Belgium, and they were trying to make ends meet. They started a bakery, and she had my grandmother, as a teenager, her job was to go and pick up the baked goods on her bicycle every morning and cycle the baked goods back to the bakery where her mom sold them. So she did that, and she then worked in the bakery, and apparently my grandfather, who was 26, 27 at the time, was one of the customers in the bakery, and he was infatuated with her, but she really had no idea who he was. She was completely disinterested in him, wasn't paying attention to him. She was a moody teenager. She was sort of in her own head a lot. She just was resentful that she had to do this and she had to do that. And then at one point, she actually was living across the street from her mother, and in the middle of the night, a man came into her room, and so, you know, she had to run away from him. And I think that scared my great-grandmother so much that when my grandfather approached her and asked if he could marry Melly, the 17-year-old, my great-grandmother was so overwhelmed with not knowing how to keep her unruly teenager safe that she said yes. And so my grandmother was told, she was working in the bakery, and her mother said to her, there's going to be a wedding. And sort of half listening, she said, oh yeah, whose wedding? And her mother said, yours. And that's how she found out she was getting married.
I think on that note, as we all sort of gasp, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Dr. Tammy Botner, pediatrician and author of Among the Reeds, the true story of how a family survived the Holocaust. We'll be right back. Thank you. Dr. Botner, tell us about the beginnings of your grandmother's marriage to your grandfather. Clearly, she was not a happy camper.
No, she wasn't a happy camper. She was entered into an arranged marriage at age 17 with a man 10 years older than her that she really didn't know. But she didn't have much choice, and so they were married. And, you know, what's really interesting is they didn't even speak the same language. My grandfather had come from Poland, and he spoke Yiddish. And my grandmother had come from Germany, and she spoke German. So they spoke to each other in different languages. they were able to understand each other because the languages are similar enough that they could understand each other. But they each stuck to their own language. And pretty much for their whole rest of their lives, they continued that pattern. I think it's a metaphor for the imperfect union that they had. My grandmother, got pregnant right away, and I'm sure she wasn't happy about that either for a lot of reasons. One is that she was only 17, and another is that it was just terribly dangerous times. So 10 months after her wedding, she had a baby. And that, as I had said before, was in April of 1940, and in early May, the Nazis came into Belgium. So it was just terrible time.
Tell us about, we've been talking about your dad earlier and what your dad dealt with early on. Code 1068, what's the connection between code 1068 and your dad?
Yeah, so we talked about how the resistance in Belgium, there was a whole underground network of people who were helping to hide Jewish children from the Nazis. And in that network, they were taxed with the problem of how to keep track of these children and keep tabs on where each child went without leaving records that would potentially cause problems if they were picked up by the wrong people. So in other words, this was a time before computers, and you know, everything had to be written down longhand on paper, and they were afraid that if they kept a big log of where everybody was, and the Nazis got a hold of that, the whole thing would come crashing down. So André Gollin, who was the woman who brought my dad into hiding, she kept a series of notebooks. And in each notebook, she only entered very minimal information. So the hidden children were given code names, first of all, and they were also given numbers. So my dad was child 1068, and his little sister, who was born in 1943, was child 1069. And in these notebooks, they would write, you know, child 1068 went to the convent at Benoît, and then, you know, some other notebook would say child 1068 parents live in, and then they would have the parents' address. And another notebook would say Bobby Botner, child 1068. So they had this very complicated system of writing things down, but only so that if one notebook was picked up by the wrong people, very minimal information could be obtained from that, if that makes sense.
It does. You're here today, which means your dad is certainly survived.
Yes.
What's happening with your dad?
So very miraculously, you know, all this terrible stuff happened during the war, and it worked. So my dad survived. His parents survived, which was truly a long shot, and also his little sister survived, and that was another very difficult story about what happened to her. So they were all reunited after the war, but you know, even though they were reunited, and that's a really good outcome, the best possible outcome, they were all scarred and traumatized from the experience. You know, my father had been in sensory deprivation and loneliness for 2.5 years. His parents, as we talked about, had been through hell, giving up their kids and hiding, running, you know, all this terrible stuff that they had to do. And here's what happened. After the war, they lived in Belgium for a few years, and then they moved to Israel. And they actually moved to Israel just a few months before Israel was a state. And they lived there for a few years, and they couldn't really settle in, and they left and they moved to Montreal. And they lived in Montreal for a while, and they couldn't settle in, and they moved to Ottawa. And then, if you can believe it or not, that whole pattern was repeated again with my father as a young adult. So what happened was people lost their ability to feel safe and comfortable in one place. They were always anxious and worried about what would happen next, when would the next shoe fall, what if scenarios were really big, what if there's an economic downturn, what if this job isn't stable, you know. And so my dad did that for decades. He moved and moved and moved and moved, and I actually moved, you know, a lot when I was a child. So there was just this, again, you know, this unsettled feeling that I think when you're so unsettled for so many years and you're in so much danger, it's hard for some people, not all, but it's hard for some people to then get over that.
Well, it's a great deal to get over.
It is a great deal to get over, for sure.
Your life today...
go ahead.
Your life, your connection today with your dad, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my dad, you know, despite all of this, early childhood trauma and all that, you know, he did extraordinarily well. He went to college, he got married, had a family, and even though we moved around a lot, you know, a happy marriage with my mom, and he's now retired and living in Florida, and, you know, I kind of wish they lived closer, but other than that, it, you know, things are really good. He's doing well.
Just the ability on his part to meet someone and to be able to form the connection to marry and to remain married and just to live, it sounds like, what is a full, hopefully relatively peaceful life, although now,
yeah,
and certainly there are challenges wherever you live. But that speaks volumes, though, to something that was an important part of him, that despite all the trauma, he could still have a connected life with people.
Here's what I think about that. He had the first 2 years of his life with his parents.
Mm.
So even though it was a very tumultuous time in the world, he was safe and he was loved, and he, in his arguably most formative years between 0 and 2, was able to have a very strong connection with his parents and was taken care of wonderfully. And even though he had trauma beginning when he was 2, he did have that foundation. And I believe that that is really what saved him. Because if he had not had that, if you take a child as an infant and you place them in sensory deprivation and without having an attachment to an adult, we know that terrible things are going to happen to that person. So I think that's what saved him. I also think that there was incredible resiliency in my family. People were really, really strong. They all made it, and they managed to continue on with their lives. They didn't fall apart. My aunt also did extremely well. She's in a happy marriage and had a family, and she had gone through a lot when she was a child. And even my grandparents, although they definitely couldn't settle down, and even though they had a rocky marriage, beginning with that arranged marriage when my grandmother was 17, they stuck it out too. So there was this sort of stick-to-itiveness and strength that, I don't know what that is. Is that genetics? Is that something else? Is that the times? I don't know. But they definitely dug deep and they made it.
You know, it's interesting as you talk about the experiences of your dad that you turned out to move towards a profession that takes care of children.
I know. I know. I think about that sometimes. I didn't do that consciously, I have to say. I didn't say, oh, my dad had a terrible time as a child, so I'm going to take care of children. I didn't do that consciously, but that is what I did. It's interesting.
It is indeed interesting. For folks listening who are, as you are, the child of a child, is there no hope? What can they do? Is there anything to be done?
Is there anything to be done with what? I'm sorry.
With the experiences that seem to have a genetic history.
Oh, I see what you're asking. I think, yes, I think there are things. I mean, we all have inherited stuff, you know. Every single person's ancestors went through stuff. I mean, it doesn't matter if you if they were immigrants or if they were soldiers or, you know, they went through famine or they went through slavery. I mean, all of our ancestors went through difficult times, and we've all inherited some echo of that in our genes, and that's just the way it is, you know. And I think some people have inherited arguably more than others, but everybody has some. And at the same time, we have some control over how we live our lives, and everything that we do does affect us also. So it's not just that we inherited stuff and we're victims of that. We've inherited stuff and we can learn how to live in a way that makes us have meaningful lives, decreases our stress, promotes health. And those are choices that everybody has every day. Focusing on the positive, spending time with people and things and causes that are meaningful, all of those things affect us in a positive way and can somewhat modify or undo some of the baggage that we all inherit.
Would you recommend, there's so much that's in the news nowadays about people going back and researching their history, and there are, I don't know, 6,500 websites that encourage you to sign up and search. Do you recommend people do that if they don't have an awareness of their history?
You mean like the genetic websites?
Yeah.
Yeah, like finding out what, where your family was from and what ethnic origin you are and all that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think it's pretty interesting and fascinating. I don't see any downside to that. In fact, I think we've probably all seen these things on social media where people who perhaps thought that they disliked a certain ethnic group and they say, oh, you know, I'm okay with being anything except for that. And then they find out that they are partly that,
right.
You know. I think that's awesome. And I think that, if anything, just shows us that we're all connected. We're all, you know, humans are humans. It doesn't really matter where you're, you know, where you're from or what religion you are. It's probably not even true. It's probably that, you know, if you go back enough generations, you're something other than what you thought you were. You know, so I think it's actually great. I haven't done it myself, but I probably will at some point.
Well, I think it's time, certainly now that you've completed Among the Reeds. Well,
and I'll find out something totally new. I'll have to write a new book.
There you go. What was it like for you, though, as you were researching and talking with your family members and getting this history? Did you find yourself experiencing anything akin to post-traumatic stress?
You know, surprisingly not. I, for so many years, had kept everything having to do with the Holocaust as far away from me as I could, because I knew that I would have a very strong emotional response. If I saw a movie, read a book, I would get very upset for a very long time. But as I started to do the research for the book and talk to primary sources and watched documentaries and read books and articles and everything and looked at pictures, which can be extremely upsetting. I think to some degree I made peace with it, or I don't know, it lost its ability to elicit that kind of strong emotional response in me to some degree. I think maybe just immersing myself in the material for a year kind of took the edge off a little bit. And so I feel like that's been a good thing for me. I have a little bit more resolution for my own feelings about what happened.
So sometimes it sounds like the knowing actually helps to heal the not knowing.
Yeah, I think so. It's almost, like confronting your demons and allowing yourself to sit with them rather than, pushing them away, I think can help us to heal and to move through that. At least that was my experience, and I think that makes sense.
How would you like people to use Among the Reeds? What were your goals for writing this book?
You know, a couple of things. One is I would love people to read this book because it's an incredible story. It is the story of a family. It's a story of courage and resilience. And it's an incredibly fascinating tale of near misses and, good luck and good decisions. And I think it just reads, many readers have told me they read it in one sitting because they couldn't wait to find out what happened next. So that's one level. It's just, I think, a great read. But secondly, I think, as we alluded to earlier in the interview, there are so many bad things happening right now in the world to immigrants and to minorities, and we're just seeing a culture of hate rearing its ugly head again. And I would love people to read this book and take it as a wake-up call to make sure to stop and squash all those kinds of things from happening, because we've seen what happens before. We've seen what the end game of that kind of situation is. And I would just encourage people to really read this and get inspired to go to that rally and protest hate and vote for people who reflect the kind of political views that you believe in.
Dr. Tammy Botner, where can people learn more about the work that you're doing with this book? And I know you're a pediatrician in Massachusetts. Where can folks find out more?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's TammyBotner.com, no spaces, just TammyBotner.com. And you can find out more about background for the book and how to buy it. It's also available on Amazon as both a Kindle book and a paperback.
So there are lots of options. There are lots of ways for people to learn more.
Yes.
Wonderful. Tammy Botner, I so much appreciate the work that you've done in this book. It really is quite the read. It really is. Once you've started it, it's kind of hard to put it down. Among the Reeds, the true story of how a family survived the Holocaust. Thank you so much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.ORG. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play, or you can go directly to iTunes and sign up that way for the free Mind Talk programming. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, and I'd love to hear from you, I'd love to hear your thoughts about today's program or any program, you can send an email to Pamela@mindtalk.org. That's Pamela at MYNDTALK.ORG. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.